Exactly.
I think that's definitely one of the things that's interesting to me about talking to people in this field, because I talk to people who graduated like what feels like 20 minutes ago. And I talk to people who are closer to our age who graduated a decade or more ago. Mm-hmm. And then I talk to people who are even further back. And really, I feel like people our age have had a very specific experience as the industry has grabbed a hold of all of this new stuff.
Yeah.
It's a lot of new stuff that you have to learn how to do that didn't, the people, our old mentors don't even know how to teach us how to do it because they never had to do it.
No, exactly. And it's like, I do some vlogging every once in a while on my YouTube channel. And I was talking about that, I don't know. I guess we kind of are in the same graduate class bracket.
Pretty close, but I'm also older than the age I gave you. So was like straight on track, I would have graduated in 2010.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, you know.
I'm going to be 35 when this comes out.
Okay. Okay, cool. When's your birthday?
In July.
Oh, July what?
28th.
Okay. So Leo.
Yeah, July Leo.
Nice.
You said that with some enthusiasm. Yeah. Where do you land?
Well, I'm Aquarius, but I know Aquarius and Leo's like, they're like,
there's a vibe.
They're kindred spirits totally. In some kind of way. So
That's absolutely right.
I love Leo's.
My
anyway,
wife is Aquarius.
Whole, is she really? Yeah. When's her birthday?
It is January 20th. Now, I have to always say it to myself with certainty because I have this weird blind spot for January birthdays. My best friend since I was in the fifth grade, School of the Arts, still my best friend, best man at my wedding.
Oh, wow.
I could not keep his fucking birthday in my head.
What?
For years. I don't know what it was. I knew it was January. I knew it was like the first 10, 15 days.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure. And then you know what's crazy now? I'll never forget it because his birthday is January 6th.
Okay, so I'm January 26th.
There you go.
And then John Odom, who graduated with mm-hmm. me, is January 6th as well.
There you go.
So, I don't know. I just keep
John
that.
And Brandon know each other. I wonder if they know their birthday buddies.
I wonder.
I bet they do.
Little Capricorns.
Right?
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
That's so fun. Yeah. I like people who have a like, kind of lighthearted, fun attitude about astrology.
Mm-hmm.
I find it insufferable when people take it too seriously.
I know. I'm definitely on the, I toe the line a little bit because I don't know, you know, when you get into the houses and the moons and all that type of stuff. And
that
and
became like, very popular. I'm not like, what, like 5 or 6 years ago, I feel like, maybe even 10-ish, people start talking about moons and things are rising. And I'm like, you lost me. I thought I had 12 things to memorize.
Exactly.
And I barely got that shit.
Yeah.
Barely. People say
I'm
Pisces.
Like,
I'm like, I think March.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you're also maybe February or April. Yeah. I'm not good enough at that. Now I got to learn your moons and your Jupiters. And they lost
me
at that shit.
All of that, I'm just like, yeah, that's cool. Like, you know, all right.
Aquarius.
You know. Yeah, I'm just like, I'm Aquarius, and I own that.
One side.
My moon and rising, like, that's cool. I don't know, but whatever.
Yeah, you
know?
Tell me if that's fun for you.
Yeah, exactly. But what I was going to say is that, sorry about the whole tangent.
Oh, I love
but,
a tangent.
You know, I did a vlog, and I was just saying about, you know, self-promotion and how I came up and, you know, our age bracket really came up at the time when that stuff was just starting. And so, you know, it takes me, and I'm still trying to wrap my mind around, you know, the social media self-promotion aspect without coming off as a narcissist or, you know, look at me, look how great my life is. And it's really hard. And I look at other actors that I know, you know, in the business that I've worked with, who are just so natural at it and do it, and it doesn't seem pretentious. It doesn't seem like they're bragging. And it's, you know, I'm just trying to find the balance with it all. And I think it's a beautiful thing to be able to do if you can master, you know, the social media, you know, letting you into my life and then still attracting like cool casting directors and projects that are like, yeah, I want to work with that person, you know?
I think here's the thing that I think is cool about it. Breezing past all the things I resent about it, because I feel like those are more obvious, right?
Yeah.
The main one, of course, being that it's part of a skill set that when you and I set out to do things like what we do very different things, but things like what we do, what attracted us to it, that wasn't part of the deal. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't part of what we were signing up to do. And now here we are, we found ourselves kind of playing this game where that's one of the new rules. If you want to kind of participate, doesn't mean that it's the only way to get successful. Thank goodness.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean that you can't get successful in spite of it, but that will make it harder. All these things. But here's what I like about it. And I think there's a few different ways into that that are really fun. Mm-hmm. I was just talking to one of my best friends about this because he feels the same struggle as an actor. He's like, I like my privacy. I don't want people in there. In my life. Like, oh, I'm going to the mall. I'm going with my wife. I'm at an audition. I'm doing a whatever. I don't want you in that. And I was like, that is legit.
Yeah.
And I don't think that someone who feels that way shouldn't be allowed to be an actor. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, I think that's a bullshit kind of setup.
I don't think that that is like a prerequisite for being an actor.
But you got to find a way to still play the game.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a few cool ways for me about that. You don't have to show them everything.
Exactly.
I think that's the misconception. People think it's an all or nothing thing. Like, well, I don't want to do an Instagram story as I walk to mundane tasks.
Yeah.
So don't.
Yeah.
Don't make anything. Any content. And I mean this for real. If you can afford to, and by which I mean like your life, you know, your necessities. If you can afford to, don't do any content you don't want to do.
Yeah, it's true.
Don't do a commercial that you don't want to support that product. Don't do a TV show that you're like, last season kind of, I thought it was a little offensive. I didn't, but maybe this season, now that I'm there. Man, take the gig.
That's
if you can afford to pay your bills, don't do it.
Yeah.
Same thing with this. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to make a piece of content because you're worried it's going to come off phony. If you record that video, we're like, oh, I'm doing the thing. We just did one just now for the podcast. If you watch that back and you're like, oh, shit, for whatever reason, I just don't like that. Don't post that shit. Just don't.
Yeah.
But you have to get more ambitious about creating stuff so that you can find out what you don't have a problem sharing with everybody.
Yeah.
And just because you shoot it on the camera app. Don't shoot it in Instagram.
Yeah.
Don't shoot it in TikTok.
Yeah.
Shoot it on the camera app. And watch it back later. Try to breathe. Don't be so hard on yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and then see if like maybe there's some version of you, a part of you, a piece of you that you're totally cool being like, hey, I'm headed to this thing that I do every week. Mm-hmm. Start with something like that.
Yeah.
And talk about it because you're like, you know, normally I'm not on Instagram. I don't even like doing the shit. But this barber's the best damn barber in Glendale, period.
That's kind of how I run my social media. And it's funny, you know, people that, you know, do follow me, I feel bad sometimes because like I'll go months without posting, you know, whatever. And I'll just like pop one and be like, hey, I know I haven't been here in a while, but I really love this sandwich that I just tried, like, you know, or like what I just did over the last few months. I think I didn't post for like 3 months or something like that. And then I was like working on this project. And while I was just waiting around on set, they had a basketball gym close by. And I just was like, I like basketball. I'm you know, I'm no like Caitlin Clark. I'm not her or Lisa Leslie, but I got a little game.
You're also not like 5'4".
Yeah. I'm definitely not 5'4". Like definitely tall, 5'8.5". Might as well say 5'9". But I found the basketball court and I was like in there shooting and I just started recording. I was like, I'm going to try to like, you know, shoot myself like shooting some threes, like just see like how many threes I can do. And I just, you know, definitely didn't do many. I did, I think about 2 threes out of probably like 50 tries. I have no idea, but
I recorded social it too. Yeah.
And I just was like, oh yeah, like let me pop this on here, you know? And I like wrote a little caption, like in between waiting to go on set, found a basketball, you know, hoop and just up in here shooting some threes.
You know, it's one of my favorite stories, and people always have mixed reviews of this guy, but I'm a big fan of his story in Hollywood. It so relates to this rise that we're talking about. It happened right around the time you were leaving School of the Arts. So Dane Cook, the stand-up comedian, he's famous for breaking into comedy and exploding in a way that nobody else had ever done before. And he's the first social media comic that really got there that way. But he didn't do it the way that it's happening now because there weren't really reels. It wasn't about posting clips of you. That getting that out in scale wasn't really a thing you could do. Mm-hmm. So what he did was instead of width of engagement, it was depth of engagement. He spent all his time not on stage, responding to every MySpace comment, DM, everything. Oh, wow. And not in a flippant kind of, hey, thanks. Hey, thanks. Oh, great. It was, oh, awesome. I see that you live in Wisconsin. I love Milwaukee. Is so, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like, he would engage with wow. every single person at depth. The story that I love about him that led to is he went into an office with some execs for an overall deal. For anyone listening, that's, you know, the idea, especially at the time for comics, it was like the big break you could get because you would go in, you'd have a meeting, they'd take a look at your career, they'd take a look at your writing, they'd take a look at you as a person, and they'd say, let's give this guy a big fat check out the gate today to go work on whatever he wants to work on. And we trust that that's going to be a thing. So he's in there to get a deal. And he asks, he sees a computer in the corner and he asks if he can use it. And they're like, okay, so this is very like out of the movie, like Good Will Hunting. Let me break the rules rebel thing.
Yeah.
But he mavericks on over to the computer and he downloads quickly AOL Instant Messenger at the time.
Oh, I love this.
Logs into it. Okay. And it starts to blink, 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 blink. And it explodes. It crashes the computer.
What?
It couldn't handle the amount of influx because every single time he logged into AIM, all of his fans that he kept up with every night, every weekend were like, oh, hey, Dane, what's up, man? Are you online? Can we play video games? He would play video games with people. And the hunger to interact with him was so high that obviously he walked out with a deal. And his career, in my opinion, is one of the more fascinating stories because he also later lost almost all his money because he hired his brother as his accountant and he stole it all from him.
Oh, boy.
I know. Okay. Yeah. So separate second act that's not relevant. Yeah. But I think that depth of engagement trumps this quality of content that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think if anybody's trying to connect with a base, start with literally whoever is actively paying attention to what you do. Yeah. You're like, they're looking at every story. They like every post. Take a second and write off the fact that might be creepy if you're feeling that way about whoever that person is. And appreciate that they're giving you their attention, a thing that's hard to find.
That's so real.
And engage.
I got to say, there's, you know, definitely some people that follow me on social media that, like, they're DMing me. I'm DMing them back. Like, you know, I see them, like, commenting, leaving little emojis and stuff on my things. And I'm, like, hearting it back or, you know, whatever. But, you know, one of the big things that I would say social media played a part in for me with my career was when I did the Wendy Williams movie. Mm. And that was, I was like, wow, like this thing is really powerful, social media, and in a good way, and also in lots of negative ways as well. But I had did the first season of the show that I'm on called, it's Tyler Perry's The Oval. Mm-hmm. It came out in October or August. I can't remember. It came out in 2019. And basically, prior to that, a movie I had done had come out. And so I guess around this time, it was like summer of 2019 and Wendy Williams had her show. And I was not aware of this, but like now looking back, like now I know like kind of the synergy of the timeline of what was happening. But for me, it was like clear out of the blue at the time. Mm-hmm. But Wendy Williams, she had done her show. She was doing her show and she had made an announcement that she was going to do a biopic for Lifetime and that they were starting to, you know, write the script and also think about who they're going to cast to play her. And all of this, I didn't know anything about that at the time. But I start getting Instagram messages, comments, Twitter mentions from people that were either following me and following her or like just some of her fan base. And they were like, Sierra Payton should play Wendy Williams. Like, you know, this we cast Wendy Williams, you know, to play you, like Sierra Payton. This is who we want to play. And I'm getting these messages and I'm just like, what the heck? Like, it was just so random for me. I was like, what's going on? Like, this is so like out of the clear blue. I'm just like minding my business, you know? And it was just kind of coming in like volumes. And I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Well, maybe there's something going on in the universe with this. Like, maybe God's trying to like do something here. Mm. And so I just kind of was like, all right, let me start studying Wendy Williams, because I don't know like what this is all about, but whatever. Like, let me do some studying. Let me watch her show. Let me, you know, pick up some of her mannerisms.
With nothing but the fans suggesting that you should do it, you started doing research.
Yeah. Wow. Because I was just like, this is really, to me, it was at the time just very random. I didn't know anything about a movie happening or anything like that. And because I didn't really watch Wendy Williams at the time, so I just wasn't like aware of what was going on in that world. And so January 2020 is when I got an email from my manager saying, hey, like, casting director wants to see you.
It's a great time to get a cool job.
Yeah. And so that's a whole story, too.
It's got to be.
Anyway, I'll tell it. Why not? But I go in for the audition, nail it. And there was so much work that went into the audition. I mean, I had about 2 days to prepare the material.
How long in between the whole whatever Twitter blow up or wherever it was to the audition?
It was about 6 months, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe between 4 and 6 months, because I think I started getting those tweets around either late June or July-ish.
Word.
And they kind of kept going until about October, I want to say.
Wow.
And so I would say for me, October was when I was like, okay, I keep getting these like random tweets and Instagram things like, Sierra, you need to like, you need to just, something must be happening, you know? And I think around that time too, I was just like really about manifesting like my career, you know, like I was just like, let's put it out. I want to play more fun, interesting roles. Like, let's put it out there. You know,
Wendy Williams is a fun, interesting role.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I was just like, if any role I'm going to like attract and manifest, like let it be that, like, let's just see, you know? And so, hey, it all worked. I mean, I ended up getting the audition. When I got the audition, I had, like I said, about 2 days to prepare, maybe a day. But there's this young lady that lives near me. She's a college student. I know her mom. So like, you know, I was like, hey, would your daughter be interested in like just helping me run these lines? And she was like, sure. And so she came over, we like put up my camera and we were just like running the scenes. I recorded it. I got in like full Wendy Williams makeup and hair, just to see what I look like as that and everything.
Is that your first time like really putting time into playing a real person?
A real life person. Yes, kind of. I mean, when I was in college at School of the Arts, we did the Black History Month celebration thing, and I had to direct something, and I just basically centered it around Hurricane Katrina all of the mess that had
just happened
on
a couple of years before.
And I'm from New Orleans, and so, you know, there's just so much that was going on, and I kind of did like a fictional scenario, because that was, and I'm not, by no means am I trying to get political at all right here. But that was under the Bush administration.
Right.
And, you know, anybody can look up all the stuff that was happening during that time with Hurricane Katrina.
The FEMA disaster is famous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I played Condoleezza Rice for this like fictionalized thing. And, you know, I don't know if people know this story, but when Katrina was happening, she was out shoe shopping or something. And so,
right.
You know, anyway, I'm a little careful when I talk about that, because people are like, are you a big, like, you know, are you on that side? And I'm like, no, I just, there's,
when I was in high school, I was in New York City. I'm from Texas originally. And I was in New York City for part of high school. Uh-huh. And, everybody assumed I was a Republican. That was during the Bush administration.
Yeah.
And they're like, you're literally from the state where the guy is from. Yeah. So it's you, you're right. And I was like, I'm 15 and I don't read the newspaper, so I'm not really sure what I even think about anything.
Yeah, exactly.
I got a lot of gay friends, so I think I'm on the left. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anything. They're like, and so my history teacher drafted us, me and three other kids who were in high school in New York City who insisted they were Republicans. And he was like, but you're from Texas, so that's enough.
Yeah.
And the four of you, we did a mock debate in front of the whole school. So I had to debate on behalf of the Bush administration during the Bush-Kerry re-election.
What?
And so I know how you feel, you know? And I was really just about the attention, mm-hmm. honestly. That's why I said yes. I said, I'm new to this school, yeah. on stage yeah. in front of everyone, yeah. maybe as, you know, their enemy. But they'll know who I am after today.
Exactly.
You know? And I had to figure out what No Child Left Behind meant. Oh, my God. I had to figure out. Not only did I figure out what it was, I had to be like, this is great.
Yeah.
Come on.
Oh, my God.
What are you for? Leaving children behind?
Yeah,
terrible
exactly.
idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No. And also, just say no to drugs, you know.
Yeah, it's exactly. Like, I was like, dare I?
Yeah, exactly.
Stupid. No, but, I know what you mean.
That, so I'm always a little like weird answering that question in terms of like, have I ever played anyone else, like a real person? And I think I was like quoted for saying, yeah, I played Condoleezza Rice one time, and like people were like, what, like why would you play her? And you know, and then it's like,
you're like, it wasn't like, Universal's Condoleezza, it
yeah,
wasn't like
it wasn't it was a school play talking about Hurricane Katrina, like, you know.
And was it kind of farcical, because the whole point was she was
Yeah,
not,
it
you
was.
You weren't taking it seriously.
Was. No, I wasn't taking it seriously. It was, but it evoked a lot of emotion from everybody.
Oh,
like
I'm
watching
sure.
it.
It's
and
an emotional
also,
time, too.
And also for me personally, because
right.
my family had gone through that.
Right.
And so, but yeah, I wasn't, you know, I'm using this podcast to clear the air.
Please,
that I
finally.
Wasn't like pro whatever,
that's
you know.
Be my next question, like, Sierra, tell me honestly. I did a little research, not a lot. No. And honestly, I feel like everybody, you have some explaining to do
exactly.
about this. You know what's fun about that? I love that you played a very serious woman, but didn't take it seriously.
Yeah.
And then you played very seriously a woman that some people struggle to take seriously.
That's wow. That's
do you know
so
what
true.
I mean?
I've never even like thought about it that way.
But you're like, no, this, but Wendy Williams, I'm going to do research. I'm going to, this
I
is
did.
Serious. This isn't just some government gal shoe shop. And I got yeah, somebody to look
yeah,
into here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, because, you know, first of all, I wanted to do the role. I wanted
yeah.
the part. And so I was like, I'm going to go into this audition.
How old was she when this movie got made?
50 maybe?
50 and alive. Not
yeah.
the circumstances for a lot of biopics either.
Yeah, no. And
so
and
she's
also
like
for
around.
Someone who is so famous and infamous,
yeah.
you know, and notorious,
yeah.
you know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
people know her, people love her, people love to hate her,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
and so I was just like, okay, well, I want to do this role, but I want to give it justice, and I want to, like, you know, give all of that, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And so.
And if you're doing it right, your performance will evoke all those reactions.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's actually a pretty cool test of your skills in a way.
Hey, I don't know what it is. Now I'm like just kind of manifesting like just like fun, you know, like I just want to go on
yeah.
set and have fun. But
isn't
for me,
where
I
we
love
all started,
the challenge.
Sierra. Wasn't that where
oh.
we all began this journey?
And how far away are we? No,
okay.
let me stop. Let me.
I have to. So
I'm
I have to pause.
I'm having fun on everything I'm doing.
Because you answered my only stock question, and we've talked forever without me asking it. But
uh-huh.
since you've said it, I want to go back a little bit. Where are you from?
New Orleans.
You're from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that as far as like, what's the family dynamic? What are the mm-hmm. parents doing for work? That kind
yeah.
of stuff's interesting to me.
Yeah, no, it's always, all that stuff is so interesting. You know, grew up in New Orleans. I mean, technically kind of grew up in Mississippi, Texas, and New Orleans. But I was so young. And so finally, when I did settle in New Orleans, like that was just home. And that's
yeah.
like home base. But
Houston to Birmingham is a vibe
yeah.
all the way from left to right, isn't it? Kind
that's
of
so interesting.
It's
yeah,
not exactly
yeah.
the same, but
I've been
I
to
think,
all of those places.
I think
yeah.
of that area as very much, I guess that's the Deep South, but it's very much like at the coastal region specifically
yeah.
is what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. It's definitely a vibe for sure. But then I got to say New Orleans is like a whole different vibe.
It is unto itself.
Like,
kind of like Austin is in Texas of like, oh wow, this is different
yeah.
from the rest of the world around me.
It's so funny. I'll meet people who are like, I'm from New Orleans, but then they're like from Baton Rouge or like Thibodeau or something. I'm like, honey, you're not from New Orleans.
Right.
Like you like that's
it's,
a whole,
it's the Las Vegas of the South.
Exactly. It's like, that's a whole difference. We have a whole different accent. Like
mm-hmm.
it's just, it's different. But yeah, so, I split up time between my parents and my grandmother in Mississippi. So, you know, definitely country girl. But then also, you know, once I got to New Orleans, it just was like, it was a whole different world. I mean, just, I remember freaking out seeing a skyscraper at like 4 years old, like being in the back seat, like crying because I'd never seen that before.
Wow.
And, you know, and so.
A tall building had a very strong effect on you.
Yeah, it was. It That's was scary, but also I think, you know, I was like leaving what I was familiar to.
That may have been what made you cry.
I think that's what it was. I remember just like driving down the street and just like seeing, and I was like, no. And my dad just be like, it's okay. And I was like, okay. Like, you know, like I was like, all right.
That does seem like one of those things your like young brain would play with and make worse. You'd be like, it's falling on me. Yeah, like, it isn't.
It did. It felt, right. I think, yeah. And it, everything was so like tight together. And
as
I
if
was
your
just
whole
like,
world was crashing down.
Yeah. Right. It was definitely a, you know, I got through it obviously, but it felt very
you
traumatic.
You still remember it.
Yeah.
That's
I remember
what's key,
that.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, growing up in New Orleans, I got to say it was definitely, I mean, talking about just like culture, just like smacking you in the face, like in a good way. Mm. I mean, we lived a few blocks away from the parade route. So during Mardi Gras, like we would just walk a few blocks and the parades are there. The music, the food, you know, and also, I mean, it was the 90s as well. And so, you know, we lived in a very, you know, impoverished neighborhood. We lived in the Third Ward of New Orleans, and we lived next to or like two houses down from Bridge House, where, you know, recovering drug addicts would go, or men that, you know, were homeless or like on the brink
of being.
We called
them halfway houses.
Yeah, halfway houses. And it was called Bridge House because it was like right under the bridge going onto the I-10 freeway. And it's funny, if you watch Interview with the Vampire at the very end when Brad Pitt leaves Tom Cruise, Lestat, after talking to him, he walks out of the Coliseum movie theater, which was like diagonally away from where I lived. Mm-hmm. And then he walks and there's like this big shot and you see the bridge. They took the bridge down. They tore down the Coliseum theater. But that was like my home, you
That's
know, and
where
I just
you're
remember
from.
Just every time watching that movie, even now, it's like so nostalgic. I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that. And like, I remember there like people graffiti like Brad Pitt was here, you know,
right.
and stuff, you know, and Kid Rock shot a music video over there. And so, you know, it was just it was that type of upbringing, you know, just very just, you know, lots of love in the household. I live with my dad, my Nana, who is my grandmother. I called her Nana.
Sure.
My dad's mom, my two aunts, my Aunt Carrie, my Aunt Kim. And we just lived in like this two bedroom apartment, you know, and we had like three dogs and three cats.
How many people did you just name that lived in this?
Yeah, I
place?
Know, right? How many?
I lost track.
Me,
I wasn't counting.
My dad, my Nana, my Aunt Carrie, my Aunt Kim. So
okay,
yeah,
I did have five. Yeah, that's what
yeah.
I thought. Got
and
it.
Sometimes like my Aunt Carrie's boyfriend and you know,
who were so who were you sharing the room with? There's only two.
With my Aunt Carrie and my Nana sometimes.
Gotcha.
So yeah, so I would like sleep in the bed with my Aunt Carrie and my Nana would like be, we had like two beds in the back room.
You speak about this yeah. so wistfully and with so much like nostalgia and love.
It was.
That would drive me insane. I needed like privacy as a kid. I needed like an
alone
space.
I did, you know,
space.
I do remember that as I was like getting a little older, like maybe like around 8 years old, I want to say, they were like, you know, she needs her own space. So we had like a walk-in closet in the back and they just like cleared out like some of the stuff. And they put a little desk in there for me. And
like a little Harry Potter under the stairs.
Yeah, I had a walk-in closet, like a little radio, you know, like it was.
There is now here's what I love. You're right about the vibe and the Aquarius Leo thing. Maybe that's what it is. But here's what I love. That story does not have the way you told that story does not have an ounce of victimhood in it.
Mm.
It doesn't have an ounce of pain in the way that you tell it. And I think that same story for other people could be so easily just write down the script of what you just said and give that as a side to an actor to make a choice on. What are the odds they'd make the choice you just made? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're right.
To be like, have my own little walk-in closet. It was like, girl, you lived in a closet.
Yeah.
Like, that's the story. Yeah. Which is, I love that that's your energy for, and clearly I think that that's what matters. I think especially as we hear someone's story, I think we should take it as they tell it, as what happened. Unless you're somebody's therapist, it's not your job to redefine or restructure the way other people grew up. But I just think it's very interesting that you have that series of circumstances and you speak about it the way that you do. Do you think just the, like you said, a lot of love in the house? Was that just like it? You're like, that's not a dark memory at all for you, because you're like, I was surrounded by people who really cared about me, took care of me.
Yeah. You know, it's, and also I think just for my own work as a person in general, you know, like really just finding the good in all of it, you know? But I mean, even still, like if I didn't, I do have very just fond, loving memories of all of that. And, you know, and the thing is that, I mean, and the reality of it was very, very dysfunctional. But I think that, you know, the adults that I lived with, and especially my dad, like they were just so loving, you know, and like crazy and fun, you know, like I to this day, I'm like, gosh, like they need a reality show. You know, I mean, my Aunt Carrie, she's no longer with us, but like I have two other aunts that, you know, live in New Orleans, and my dad lives in New Orleans still. And it's just like, they're just hilarious people. And so like, thank God that I grew up around that. And, you know, and the reality of it is too, it's just like, we ask about the profession. You know, my dad, he did his best, but you know, he was really involved in drugs. He sold drugs, he used drugs. And so that was like just part of the chaos going on in the house.
Yeah.
But you know, he was very transparent with me about it, and was just very like, loving to me. You know, he was like, look, dad has an issue. You want to go to this AA meeting with me? And I was like, sure, gonna bring my Barbies. And he's like, all right, you know. And so I would sit in these like NA AA meetings with him, listen to these people's stories, sit in a corner, play with my Barbies. And I'm talking about, this was like 7-8 years old, you know. And he would get in trouble and we'd go bail him out of jail. You know, my nana would find the money to whatever, you know? And it was just like, as a kid, I always knew what was going on. You know, I was like, oh, okay. Aunt Carrie has a problem too. You know, like I found the needles, you know, it's like, whoa. And Aunt Kim was like, hey, I'm, you know, I'm going to AA too. You know, I work at a bar and I have, you know, so it was just, it was all of that, but it was like, we were always laughing and always, you know, it was just, it was, I don't know how to, and I think that's just like the culture of New Orleans too. You know, it's just like, I have friends and, you know, and even when I was younger, it was like, you wake up with some Crown Royal or Hennessy, you know, you go to work, you have a shot or two, you know, on the job. And this is like the restaurant business, you know? And so, you know, then you go home and you're nightcapping and you're, you know, you're just, it's just a part of the culture there. You
it's
know?
Also, it's, yeah, I think, I mean, obviously drinking is a part of the culture in New Orleans. I mean, there's, that's a several podcast episodes by itself.
For sure.
But I also think, I think that's part of maybe a NOLA thing, but I also think it's a
Southern.
It's a Southern thing. And I think it's a broke folks thing. Mm-hmm. I grew up working class people, and you know, the situation can be very dark, but despite what you see in film and TV on how poverty and working class people are portrayed, it's not all fucking tears, man.
It's not.
It's
That's
like,
what's so bizarre
about
it.
How would we survive?
Yeah.
If we spent every day being like, I'm so miserable. Like, is there rage? Yeah. Is there sadness? Yeah.
Yeah.
But you learn to fucking laugh.
Yeah.
You learn to get through it with a hey, punch in the shoulder, arm around your neck, I got you. You know, like, because you're in that shit together.
Yeah.
And you've got to find a way to do that. And honestly, the biggest dysfunction comes from the people who can't at least be with the dysfunction together. And then they ostracize or they hurt because they're hurt and it pushes them away. That's tough. We have a lot of that in my family. Mm-hmm. But it really, I can relate to what you're talking about in not the exact circumstances, of course, very different. But there is a kind of acceptance of circumstance.
Yeah.
Maybe to the detriment of not getting better.
Yeah. That's real.
But it is an acceptance that does allow them to function, survive, mm-hmm. parent, provide to whatever degree they can get done. I mean, I think, again, I love the way you tell your stories. Another person could hear the story about you at that AA meeting at 7 years old with the Barbies and be like, how could he? How yeah. that, you know, she doesn't mm-hmm. belong there. And to show it, to tell her about that, to share that part of you with her is damaging, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But like, look, folks, bullshit. yeah. And I point to that in my own life, too. Like,
yeah.
there are things that can send us astray. But I think we spend a lot of time judging the circumstances that we are not in and trying to tell other people how to do it.
Yeah.
And it would be so easy to do that with some of the stories that you've told. And I think you are a great testament to how a healthy person can still emerge from that, a successful person can still emerge from that. Mm. And I think that transparency, I'm not a therapist, my wife is, but I think that transparency that your family offered through their own struggle and trauma, miles ahead of trying to bury it, miles ahead for you.
I think so. I mean, I you know, again, I'm not a therapist right. either, so I don't know what the right, you know, way is for any of
and
that.
And I insist there isn't one.
Yeah.
There's
yeah,
better
there
and worse.
Isn't. There definitely isn't. Yeah, there's no, like, real cookie cutter way. But I do know that, you know, even from my own experience and just as an actor and learning human behavior and stuff, I do think when we venture into the victimhood mentality, like right. that's not really the right way to go, you know, or it's not the, it's just not the most productive way
helpful
to go.
Helpful is the word yeah. I was going to use. Yeah, yeah, I agree.
And I've been there, you know, I've been in the victim, like, oh my God,
yeah.
my dad was on drugs and I just like, why, you know, why can't I get a break, you know, type of sure. thing. And it's just like, you know, I had to do my own work to really pull myself out of that, you
yeah.
know? And I think it's just, again, it's just being really transparent and really just like, look, at the end of the day, like, no one's had a perfect childhood.
Right.
You know, shit happened, things happened, everybody's gone through their stuff. Doesn't make you unique in any type of way, Sierra, that, you know, you went through something, you know, or whatever, like your family is this or whatever. And it's just like, okay, those are the cards you got dealt. Where do you go from there now?
What makes you special, in my opinion, and I mean you royally, mm-hmm. what makes you special is how you respond to those circumstances.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't talk about her very often, but it is an important parallel. My sister and I don't talk very much. We're mm-hmm. not very close. Mm-hmm. We were both born into very difficult circumstances for us. I want to make that comparatively because there's always somebody's got a worse situation. I had a bedroom that was not a closet. So I'm acknowledging that there's
nice,
some,
cool.
Yeah. A little stuff, you know, yeah. little stuff. Maybe not always a door, but, a room. Yeah. So, anyway, but my sister is quite a bit older than me. She was born to my mom when my mom was still in high school. A very different journey than I had. My mom was, you know, 26, 27 when she had me. Different yeah. situation. However, we were raised essentially by the same people, mostly. Uh-huh. And we are just totally, totally different people. Very, very different. And I don't just mean our personalities, like, I'm loud, she's quiet. I mean, like, the way we think about life, the world, is fundamentally different. Mm. My wife is 14 months apart from her brother. They are very different, but they're really similar too. Because uh-huh. they grew up together and they have similar things. My sister and I had similar lives, and yet we chose to deal with the cards we were dealt very, yeah. very differently. And at turn after turn, I was not interested in being defined by the circumstances I was brought up in. It seems difficult for her to live in a world where she's not.
Yeah.
And those can be very difficult people to keep around you because you're like, I'm trying to focus on the
exactly.
positive, on the up, on the smile, on the, you know, let's go. And yeah. and it's like, it can be a drag to kind of pull that down. I get the impression in the very short time I've known you, you are one of those people is up. Let's go. Let's move up. Let's do better. It's just like in you, is it not?
Yeah, I feel like it is.
For you and for others.
I mean, I just think that, gosh, I mean, just where I'm at now in my life, like that's where I want to be. That's what I choose, you know. And I mean, not to say that we, you know, I don't have challenges. People don't have challenges, but it's just like, I'd rather do the hard work of, you know, getting through my own BS and any kind of victimness and looking at the detriment of society,
right,
and be on the other side of that in terms of like being on the up, you know, having a healthier mindset than, you know, where I had been before, you know what I mean? And also I think too, I mean, I gotta say, I think one of the catalysts for me, really kind of thinking outside of the circumstances was, you know, reading and learning about Dr. Maya Angelou when I was 12 years old. I mean, that rocked my world. My Aunt Kathy, who lived in Florida, who's my dad's sister, she didn't live with us, but, you know, she lived way in Florida. I mean, she gave me these Maya Angelou books. And it's funny. Okay, I didn't say this earlier, but my dad is biracial and he grew up with his white side of the family. He didn't really know his black side of the family. That's a whole story there because it was an affair and his black father, you know, got chased out of town by the Ku Klux Klan. So he like never really got to know him or anything.
Coming on episode two.
Yeah. Episode two, guys. But so he was raised by his white side of the family. And so when I lived with him, that's who, you know, I lived with. And, you know, some of my aunts, they're, you know, trying their best to be like, she needs to learn about her blackness, you know, like, and so my Aunt Kathy,
these are biracial ladies or white ladies?
They're white ladies. Sorry, I didn't say that. So my dad's mother is white. His biological father is black, but he was raised by his stepfather who was white.
Got it.
All of his sisters and brother.
That is white. An interesting dynamic it to add into
very,
that.
Very, very interesting so, dynamic so
your,
for sure.
So your white aunties are like, she needs to learn how to be black.
Yeah. Or like they wanted to expose me to some like blackness, but they didn't want to like beat me over the head with it. You know what I mean?
What would that even look like?
I know. It was very interesting.
God bless them for trying to navigate it.
They were trying.
That's where the credit deserves. Yeah. And I always try to say this to anybody. My wife's Korean and I mentioned that as a mixed race couple, it is so important for me, especially in LA, especially I'm very liberal minded, but it's like, we've got to focus on allies where we can find them. And if they're if they're saying the wrong words, but their heart's in the right place, baby, let's talk.
Yeah.
Like, let's get there. And growing up in that belt that I'm talking about, there are so many well-meaning white folks who want to help. They want to do the right thing. They have so much love in their heart. They do not say the right shit because they don't know what the rules are. They may even
North
not
Carolina
like
School of the Arts for
they
me.
May, yeah, they may not even like that there are rules.
Yeah.
But there is love in their heart in a kind of universal way. And I'm always trying to be like, let's highlight that. Let's pull that out. Cause those people are not hateful. They're not trying to be part of the problem. So what is that experience then for you to get that? How did they go about that?
Also, I gotta say for anybody listening, and I saw this tweet maybe a year ago or something, and there was like this like white guy in New Orleans during Mardi Gras, like listening to some rap music and was like bobbing his head, and somebody tweeted, they're like, man, white people in New Orleans are just different breeds, you know, because like they're so like down, I guess, you know, like I'm like using like very probably political incorrect terminology
I know what you're getting at.
But like
I've been accused of that downness before in my life and not knowing how to cope with it.
You know, like, so it's, I don't know. I mean, obviously it's not all New Orleans whites or all New Orleans blacks, whatever. I don't know. This is like real. We're getting into murky territory because I don't want to be misquoted in any kind of way.
100%. But let me put a clarifying thing on it as the white man in this conversation. Again, I'm going back to the point of what is key in all of these issues. If we ever really sincerely, I'll make a joke, sincerely, if there is to be any progress constantly moving forward in this area, we have to take people for the benefit of the doubt that are coming from a loving place and not tear apart the language that they choose or whatever, because those are not the big problems.
Yeah.
And you are distracted if that is the stuff. So if anyone wants to find some quote of the thing that you just said and take it out of context, they could. But know that this quote is right after it. Get out of here.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Get out of here, please.
Take a little context and understand that your heart is in the right place. My heart is in the right place. That is not the issue that's going on here. But what we can't do as, you know, left-leaning progressive people who wanted to get better is be so afraid of the language that we don't have a conversation.
Yeah.
And
so true.
I am fascinated in this dynamic that you have laid out where your father is biracial, but you're growing up in essentially an all white house and a tight, very tightly filled white house. And your aunties are so, they so want to help, but they don't know how to do that.
Not, you know, not necessarily, but then sometimes, like, I just remember Aunt Kathy was like, you need to read Dr. Maya Angelou. You need to read these books,
Maya Angelou.
And I was like, okay. You know?
And you ended up kind of down the street from her for a while because she's in Winston for a long time.
And I ended up being one of her students.
You got to meet her?
I got to meet her. I got to sit with her.
That was my next question. That's so cool.
Amazing, you know, mother earth of a woman, just like
Do you have
everything.
Like a favorite quote? Or I have one, is why I asked. Do you have like a favorite thing
just,
of hers?
You know,
I know it's a lot
still
to choose
I rise, from. You know, that poem just, yeah. I mean, and just like, I don't know. I mean, when I met her and I got to spend time with her, I mean, she was like prophesizing over me and like my life and my career and like, I was just like, whoa, I receive all of it. You know, like, thank you.
That's
know?
How I felt about Gerald.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's not, you know, I think that is a magical thing when it can happen for you. And it's like, it's unfortunate because I think sometimes we're really hungry for that. And that person just isn't in our life yet. Hopefully yet. But I'm so glad that you were able to have that.
I mean, it's.
Especially she's not with us anymore. Yeah. So it's like, that's a very special thing.
It was just. Full circle. And I'm very, I mean, I could talk for hours and hours about it, but I'm just so grateful and indebted to God and the universe for just like allowing that to, for allowing me to have that experience. Mm-hmm. Because again, it's just like the household that I grew up in and, you know, just the dynamic too of, you know, even like splitting up between those different households and then like going to those different spaces and stuff growing up, you know, there was, it was at times like, am I trapped in this? Am I, you know, and then to like read, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings. And like this woman grew up in, you know, Arkansas and, you know, split between her mom and her dad and her grandmother and grew up in a very rural town that didn't feel like she would ever get out of. And then next thing you know, she's traveling to Italy and she speaks Italian and French and, you know, and like she's like performing for Bill Clinton at, you know, it's like just seeing that representation and like having my like white blonde hair, blue eyed Aunt Kathy give me these books, you know, it's just like, it's such the dynamic of it. I couldn't ask for anything, you know, better. And So, I mean, that, where am I going here with this? This was to answer your question about my upbringing. Like, I'm from New Orleans and what was my parents' occupation?
This is one of the most tangential podcasts ever. That's why people always ask me, like, can I prepare? I'm like, good luck.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
I'm getting all the things that I want to know. I'm fascinated by it. And I think that's the other thing is the reason why this show never has any structure is because I want it. For real, because I want it to be motivated by enthusiasm. And we're going to talk about what's interesting to us. Mm-hmm. And I find people will say the thing that they want to say eventually.
Yeah,
and especially people
true.
Are walking into a room with, I got to talk about, I want to bring this up. Mm. They never walk out and don't bring it up. Even if it's a tangential or non sequitur, like, oh, and this, it'll happen. It'll always happen. Yeah. I do want to talk about the organization a little bit.
Yeah.
We get into that.
Okay.
Why don't you lay it out? I don't want to.
I will lay it out.
Misquote anything.
The Michael's Daughter Foundation. So my dad's Michael. We just finished talking about him and his family.
See? Segue.
Yeah, segue. So I, 2008, I want to say, I think that's when it was. Yeah. Or 2007, I think, School of the Arts, I was there. I might be going too far back to really tell this story about the nonprofit organization, but anyway,
that's all right.
I'm going to try to like not make it too long-winded. You could probably edit that whole explanation out right there, just cut down time.
Not doing it.
But so you know, my father, he had gotten his second prison sentence in Louisiana for drug possession. Both of them had been for drug possession, and also with like the intent to sell. As well. And so
I don't think drug possession should be a crime. That's
I don't
my
think
opinion.
So either.
I don't think specifically it should ever be a crime.
And I'm not just saying that because I'm his daughter or, you know, I've known people that have spent time behind bars because of that. I just, you know, it, possession and use of it just speaks to a larger problem. And I just,
it's criminalizing addiction.
Yeah,
it's exactly. It's totally different. You want to have a different conversation about intent to sell. You want to have different which they're way too loose with that, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, when I have a conversation about distribution, stuff like that, I am more open to a conversation about laws around that.
But yeah.
Anything that puts addicts in a position to be criminalized for being an addict, that's one of the reasons why I really want to talk to you about it, because it is kind of close to my heart, but okay. It also is just like, I'm so glad that work is being done in this area. And so yeah. Please.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, he went to prison. He was sentenced to 10 years, but he ended up getting out for good behavior early. But yeah, it was 2007, 2008. I was still at School of the Arts. And a lot of, you know, while I was at School of the Arts, I didn't really like let a lot of people into what was going on behind the scenes. Mm. A lot of people had assumptions about me being privileged and, you know, very well off. And I just was like, whatever, you know.
You just didn't tell them the closet story.
Yeah, I didn't tell them the closet. No one really knew the closet story, you know. Like, I think this is probably one of my first or second times telling the closet story.
It's fascinating because normally the School of the Arts is a popular place for closet related stories. Yeah,
exactly. And it's just like, Sierra was in the closet. Like, I'm out now, like in a heterosexual relationship with my man, but hey, you know, like,
so I'm sorry. Again.
Yeah. No, it's all good. But you know, again, my mindset too was very I feel like I've always been more like on the hopeful, you know, faithful, you know, I'm going to make a way out of no way side.
Oh, idealism in there.
Yeah. You know, but when my dad went back to prison again, that was hard, you know, and it was confusing. And I think in college, just getting out of college, and it was just like, what the heck, man? Like, what's going on? And so I ended up graduating in 2008, went to New York. You know, just starting out in my career, but also just like just trying to navigate like womanhood and making sense of, you know, where I came from. And it was like weird. I felt like it was an existential crisis time for me coming out of college. And just like, you know, I feel like college was supposed to be about self-discovery, who you were, craft as an actor, all that type of stuff. But I think that kind of started coming later for me after I graduated.
Very common.
And yeah.
By the way, as someone who's been talking to these people for a very, very long time, that's very normal.
Yeah. And I'm still figuring it out, you know, like I definitely don't want to sit up here and be like, I got it all figured out, but
no, we're never done.
No, never, never. And, I ended up moving to LA. So New York was like, you know, I'm like just trying to get my feet on the ground. I moved to LA. And that was in 2010, and this was like right after I tested for a TV show, one of those life-changing things, and I didn't get it, and I was devastated, but my agent was like, you need to find a way to move to LA, and I was like, all right, and I had a godmother that lived in Riverside, and I just worked it out, and eventually I had to move out of there, and so I got like a little studio apartment in MacArthur Park, and my relationship to my dad at that time, you know, it had been 2 years since he had been incarcerated. And, you know, I skirted around a lot, but it was very strained because I was upset with him for going back to prison again.
Yeah.
And I couldn't make sense of it. And so he would send me letters like all the time. And I got to a point where I just like stopped reading the letters. I stopped answering the prison calls because I was just like, yo, man, like get your stuff together.
Right.
But also I was just like, I'm out here like struggling and trying to like make my way as an actor, and like my classmates, they had better upbringings than I did, and like, you know, they're out here like crushing it, or you know, like there was a lot of blame and victimhood. Yeah. And I just was like just trying to figure stuff out.
Life
and
so, is hard enough.
Yeah. And so
I get that.
I was just like in this studio apartment, like paying, like struggling to pay like $600 a month. I was working like any restaurant job, catering job I could get, right. Just like trying to just figure things out and just be like, why is this stuff so hard? You know, like here I am. I just could have gotten this TV show where I'm making like, you know, $200,000-$300,000 a year. And like that didn't happen. And now I'm like, don't even have like $40 to like pay to keep the lights on. You know, I was like, what the hell, man? And I just remember I didn't have a mattress or anything. I was just like, the studio apartment was probably like the size of like this like podcast space right here, right. You know? I just remember like laying on the floor and I saw the shoebox that I had of the letters that I hadn't opened. Mm. And I was just like, I don't know. I had a moment where I was just like sitting there and I was bored, but frustrated. And you know, all of those things when you're like sitting in silence and solitude, you know?
Right.
So I was like, let me just read these letters. Like, what is my dad talking about? You know? And I opened them and he was like telling me his life story, but with that like same care and joy and, you know, humor and, you know, and then he would like end the stories of like, I believe in you, Sierra, like you can do like, oh God, I'm going to like get choked up now, but you know, like you can do this. Like it was right. like motivating. And I was like, whoa, this is okay. You know, like how can I be mad at this? Like, how can I be mad at this man? You know, like how can I be, you know, like I had every right to be, but I was just like, you know, this is giving me some fuel to like, just keep going after this acting career, you know? And so I don't know, just something came over me. I was like, I want to just share about this. I want to write about this. And so I wrote a one woman show, just kind of put all of my, you know, heart and sweat and tears and everything into it. And like, I just remember working at all these different restaurants and, you know, after I would get off of like a double shift or whatever, like it didn't matter what it was. Like I'd still go home and I just would be writing and, you know, using the letters and everything. And so, and then like, I started like putting my aunt's voices into it, just making it funny, like all this stuff. And I started performing it around Los Angeles and, I got invited to do it up in San Francisco. I don't know. I'm trying to, you know, not make it too long-winded, but
no, tell the story.
I was also hired during the summers to like teach theater and acting to like, you know, in different youth organizations and stuff.
Done a lot of that.
Yeah. And so, and it's great. I love that work.
Very rewarding. Yeah.
And I just was like getting all this like great feedback from the play whenever I would do it. You know, highlighting, you know, just the experience of having an incarcerated father and just like the upbringing and, you know, and stuff like that. And when I performed it at this one, I got invited to perform at a high school. And that was just when something clicked. I was like, oh, well, these young people are telling me that, you know, they have parents incarcerated. Even in some of the youth organizations that I worked with prior to, there were girls that I knew that, you know, especially when I worked in New Orleans, there were girls that I knew that were visiting their parents at the same prison. You know what I mean? And so I was like, man, okay, rewind, Sierra. Like, you love acting. You love young people. You have, you know, a story that people are relating to. Like, why don't you, you know, and you're not really loving the restaurant life, you know? Like, it's okay. You're meeting cool people and stuff. Right. But it's like, it's hard work and, you know, why don't you try to figure out how to venture into more creative fields and see if you can like make some money doing, you know, doing the things that you love doing, aside from acting. The acting stuff's going to come. Like, don't worry about that. Like, just know it's going to come. But like, what can you be doing on the side that's like just as rewarding and fun? And so I was like, all right, I'm going to try to create this program, nonprofit thing. I don't know. Like, let's just see what it is. And it was just like magic just started happening. I was like, I wrote this idea down of like, I want to work with inner city youth. I want to work with youth that have parents that are incarcerated. I also want to like try to work with the parents and the adults as well to just like, you know, talk about it, give them a platform, give them a safe space to share their story, to talk about what's going on, and to like also motivate, empower, and inspire like Dr. Angelo, you know, did for me, you know?
Right.
And so I just started Googling like grants or whatever. I got funded. I found a grant from the Los Angeles Department of Cultural Affairs, got funded to do the work. You know, they gave me some money for like a pilot program, and it just became this like thing, and they just started funding me like every year. And then over the pandemic, I ended up, just, I'd filed like one thing to like make it a 501c3, like a few years prior, but I didn't know all the official steps you have to take. So over the pandemic, I was like, all right, well, I got time. So let me like research and look into all of this. It's a good time
for bureaucracy.
Exactly. Exactly. And so shout out to USC's Small Business Clinic. A good friend of mine was like, go and talk to them and see if they could help you get this nonprofit stuff set up. And also like my LLC. And I was like, let's do it. And so they did. They helped me out. This young woman named Karen, who's like the coolest Karen in the world. Karen Chillian, I think that's her last name. Shout out to her. She was a student there, and she just like worked with me, and you know, her professor held both of our hands to like figure this whole thing out. And then the thing was born. And, you know, I was like, the first year, obviously we didn't have any funding at all. And so I just was like, you know what, I'm going to really put my head to it and just apply for every grant that I can find and just call and do what I can. And so finally last year we got funding for this year from the California Arts Council and also from the Bancroft Family Foundation to now set out and like do this work. And we're now placed in two schools, Carson High and Gals Los Angeles. And we are, you know, working with the principals to really scout out those high need students. And they're going to do the work that the program has been is creating original plays, documentaries, and short films, and presenting that work to the city of Los Angeles or whoever wants to see it. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And definitely, you know, now that it's scaling a little bit bigger now, I got my work cut out for me. But it's cool because like I can now hire people and I don't have to like do every single job like what I've done before with it. And that's like, that's actually what I'm enjoying a lot is to be able to hire other, you know, creatives that can come along and, you know, help this venture and be able to put some funds in other artists' pockets as well. So,
you know, yeah. What you really appreciate when you get older that I just don't think you could give a shit about when you're younger, if you mm-hmm. tried what? Creating jobs.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I'm fucking good at feet. I've done it too with businesses and stuff.
Yeah.
To know, especially if it's a cool ass job that pays pretty good.
Yeah.
To like be able to give that to someone, because you take it for granted before you're really a working person that there's all these jobs out there someone's yeah, given.
Exactly.
There's a bunch of jobs. Go get a job. There's a bunch of
crappy jobs.
That's what everyone says. Yeah. Get a job. Get a fucking job. And you're like, all right. And you spend a long time trying to get a job, but depending on what you do, man, that can be a uphill battle, as we've, you know, talked about just now.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in that position to create, obviously it's a beautiful and wonderful thing that you're doing for the kids. So because it needs to be said to you as much as possible, thank you for doing that work.
Oh man.
But also what a great thing to be able to give work to other people who believe in the same things you do, that are willing to execute your vision with enthusiasm and passion. I mean, first of all, that's really hard to find. So good luck.
Yeah.
Always
yeah.
finding the right
Thank
people
you.
For that.
Thank
I know
you,
how hard that
I'm
can
like,
be.
Yeah.
But when you find it,
yeah,
you'll both be so grateful for each other, like you are for family, because yeah. you're like, this thing matters to me. And the fact that it's in your hands, I can trust you with it, is such a good thing. And they're going to be like, this thing's fucking cool. Thank you for making a really cool thing for me to do yeah. and spend my time on, so I don't have to be at the restaurant or whatever their restaurant might be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Come on, teaching artists. I need you guys. Yeah. so yeah.
They're there.
Yeah. yeah
they're there, and they're on the way. I'm faithful because I think the need has gravity, and I think that gravity will pull them in. Mm. You know, it's not a superfluous kind of thing you're doing. It's necessary. Yeah. And I think there's a bunch of ways to do it, you know, without getting into any privacy things that might bother somebody. My wife has been working with a local LA school that recently dealt with suicide amongst their minority community. And they are working with my wife and a number of other therapists, organization that she works with, to try to figure out what they need, how to help, what to do. I mean, that is a hard question to answer. And it's obviously individual, but it's also a community question. Mm-hmm. And I think that their methodology that they're trying to put in place now of having more mental health assistance available is great.
Yeah.
But what you're doing is great too. It's a very different approach to trying to help people that are young, that are dealing with, let's face it, adult shit, trauma shit. They need help in more ways than one. And I think talking to a therapist is very helpful. But write a play, make a movie, do it, you know, take the things that are fun for you.
Exactly.
And marry that to the work of dealing with something difficult, which I think maybe makes some people nervous because they're like, well, we're going to make, that's very private. We're going to make a movie about how your dad's in prison. And it's like, well, I might, cause it's my life and that's my story. It's a part of what we're doing here.
Exactly. And you know, it's what I learned from when I wrote my own play and what I've been learning from doing this work over the years. It's really touching on subjects with a delicate matter, but also like not sitting in it and figuring out how to, you know, shift the story to, and it's not about like toxic positivity or anything like that, but it's just like, you know, no, I'm not interested in us just like writing and talking about like the detriments of, you know, my dad's on drugs, you know, and like how that makes me upset. Life.
I think you already know the detriments.
Yeah. You know, it's just like, exactly. It's just like, okay. And you know, when I wrote my one woman play, I did this like off Broadway play years prior. And it was like this really deep and heavy subject matter. And I remember the director was like, well, we're not going to play this like sad, suffering, depressed. Like, you know, we're going to laugh at ourselves about it. And I was like, oh, that's a really interesting approach. And so it just brought a whole different dynamic to it. And so when I was writing my play, it wasn't like, like, Aunt Carrie's doing heroin. Like, it wasn't like that, but it was just very like taking kind of like how my family was. Like, they just, it was just life. You know, I remember like I had a line in there, like, my Aunt Kathy's like, but it's just life, Sierra. It's just life. You know, like very... Yeah. And it was like, okay. So I approached it that way. And, you know, just, yeah, I had, you know, you have to tell a story. You got to have the ups and downs and the dynamics and the climax and the, you know, everything. But I did just pepper in as much lightheartedness as I could because it was like what I knew. And so when I work with these young people, you know, and when I first started, I was a, you know, social justice warrior and, you know, prison reform. And I'm very much still that now.
Sure. You still but have those values.
I still have those values. But when I first was going into this work, it was very much like, tell me how you feel about this. Like, what is like, how can we like give the message to like, you know, to the politicians and, you know, stick it to them and everything.
Let's
and it
change was just, the world this year.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just like, you know, at first, okay, I think we had to go there at first. But then as it's developed and, you know, grown over the years, you know, and I would say 1 year, which really changed the direction that I'm going in with it now, which changed it for the better. Mm-hmm. You know, I went in kind of with that mindset of like, we're going to talk about like, I was working with a very, the neighborhood is really like highly populated with, it's a Hispanic community.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of talk of, you know, deportation and stuff like that. And so I was like, we're going to go and talk about this. And like, I know that there's like, you know, some of the parents are, you know, have different substance abuse issues. Like, we're going to make a play or a movie about this and talk about these things. And I just remember the kids were like, can we just do like a superhero movie? And I was just like, oh yeah, you can. Like,
yeah.
What am I doing? And not to say, you know, I'm definitely like animating it a lot. Like, I wasn't like
show me your pain, kids, you know, but just, I went in with this, you know, idea of like, we're going to really talk about these issues and we're going to do movies on these issues.
Yeah.
And then the kids are just like, well, we just want to do like a superhero movie. Like, I want to play a Marvel superhero. And I was just like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Well, what do you guys want this short film to be about? What do you want to like, you know, and they start adding their things to it and peppering these things here and there. And, you know, they're having fun. They're laughing. They're, you know, having a great time. I'm like, oh, my God, like, cool. And then what the crazy thing about it, because it's their story without having to talk about these things, they just come up naturally.
Yep.
You know? I was just like, okay, do y'all even need me? You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, here's the camera, kids. Here's but a pen and paper. You know what I'm saying?
They do need you, and that they need you because they wouldn't have done this before you got there.
Yeah.
And any director will tell you, Gerald used to say it, it's in every book about directing. 90% of the job is putting the right people in place and then getting out of their way.
Yeah.
That is the job. That doesn't make it not a job. Just because, you know how fucking hard that is to get all the right people in the right spot? Oh, like I just said, with your organization, you're going to have the same struggle of getting exactly the right people in exactly the right spot. It's one of the hardest things to do in the world. That's why directors get paid well when they do their job. It doesn't mean that it correlates the same way to another job as far as time and energy. So one of the reasons why I like being a director and I like being a producer is it's a skill set I've been working on my whole life without even meaning to.
Yeah.
And I'm still half-ass okay at it. It's hard. Yeah. It's really hard.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But if you can do it, magic fucking happens. Magic.
Yeah.
Like unbelievable. And like you say, if you're really crushing it as a leader, as a director, any role at the top of the pyramid, if you're really crushing it, you should regularly feel like, do I even need to be here? That means you're doing a good job because everything is working. The factory is it's taking in rubber. It's spitting out tennis balls. That's on time. The shipments are out. But there's nothing for me to do right now. Well, because you already did it. And the fact that this thing is all running is evidence of that. But as hardworking people, standing still feels uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Which is fine because that works out because you're also a talented actor. So there's other stuff for you to do.
Yeah.
You don't have to always be. But that'll be the great balance, right? That's what you're trying to build.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you're right on track for that. That's so cool.
Well, thank you. Thank you, man. I appreciate that. I'm, you know, just trying to figure it out one step at a time. But yeah, it's definitely, it's coming together. I feel that for sure.
So, that's awesome. Yeah. To your benefit and so many others. Thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, thank
you. That's such a good time talking to
I'm
you.
I'm having a great time. Like,
I'm sorry we have
going.
To cut
no,
it. Yeah, I know.
No, I have to. I'm just saying.
We've got to move on with our lives, unfortunately. But you're welcome to come back anytime.
We'll
do another one. We'll get... there was a clan story somewhere in there with your
dad.
There
was, yeah. There's so many stories.
There's some stuff in there.
There's a Steven Seagal story. There's so much, you know.
Now I'm really excited.
We'll tease that for next time.
I love a good Steven Seagal story.
And then you have to come on as I'm building my podcast.
I would love to.
You have to come on too. So
yeah.
We'll continue.
That sounds wonderful.
We'll have Rob and Sierra time. So,
yeah. Hell yes.
Aquarius and Leo time.
Aquarius and Leo in this bitch.
Yes.
thank you.
Thank you.